afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It's a Monday, August the 13th, 2018. 13 coming up on 14 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into the Now program. Quick programming note, I want to remind you that, as many of you know, we lost a good friend of this program, actress Charlotte Ray, last week at the age of 92. And tomorrow, her son, Larry Strauss, will be on for his first interview since her passing and memorial service. Tomorrow, Charlotte Ray's son, Larry Strauss, tomorrow, 12:15, here on the Now program. Now today, we have a gentleman on who we have had on in the past, but certainly no more important time to have this gentleman on to discuss things that are going on in the world between the FBI and the one-year anniversary of Charlottesville and the president's comments about LeBron James and this being the 50th commemoration year of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. His friend, co-speechwriter, and lawyer, Clarence B. Jones. Mr. Jones, always a pleasure to have you on. How are you doing?
Hi, how are you, sir?
Good.
Where's you? How's the weather out there? I'm in Palo Alto, California. Of course, our state is plagued by forest fires so many places, but here in the sanctuary of Palo Alto, directly across the street from Stanford University, and it's kind of beautiful, although occasionally we do get some smoke and haze. Anyway, to the subject at hand, that's an understatement the way you introduced the segment. Wow. Okay.
It's tremendous because there is so much news flooding us every day. So I guess let's start with yesterday, the one-year anniversary of Charlottesville. The white nationalist, I think, is what they call themselves now. Mm-hmm. We're marching in Washington, but apparently it was a very small group. And mm-hmm. the group on the other side who were against them were out in much greater force. What does that tell you, and what do you make of that?
Well, I wouldn't... I'm less... the comparative numbers can be interpreted by different people, but I'm less concerned about whether the white nationalists had 20, 30, or 100 people and the people opposing them had 1,000 people. To me, that's a secondary issue. The fundamental issue is what's the dispute all about. It's the question we have. We as a nation have been, we still are haunted. It's like the elephant in the room that everybody sees, nobody wants to talk about, and that's the continually unresolved issue of race in America. And in this specific case is the question of the monuments in Charlottesville, Virginia. Now, why were the monuments put up there in the first place? Okay, they were put up there in the first place because they wanted to have a memorial, a statuesque remembrance, memorial of the leaders of the Confederacy, and the military leaders of the Confederacy. And what did the military leaders of the Confederacy do? They led the 13 states who decided to secede from the Union in open rebellion to the national government of the United States on one issue only. Now, the historians will try to cover up, but there's only one issue, and that's the issue of whether slavery would be abolished or continue in the United States. And so the question, therefore, has to be raised. Do we really want to have, in this 21st century, monuments, statues, to the leaders who led our country in treasonous, insurrectionary rebellion in order to defend the institution of slavery? Is that what America's about? Do we really want to? Now, I'm not one that says there should be no memorabilia for people on the Confederate side who lost the war. And I don't say that. I say the history is history. And I think that appropriate artifacts and whatever they may be should be a part of any museum. But statues in public places, just remember these are public places, where their very presence says in effect that we are paying a public remembrance of people who led a rebellion against the United States. And what was the purpose of the rebellion? To preserve the institution of slavery. Now, that's not very complicated.
You know what's interesting to me? When it happened last year and yesterday's events, what puzzles me is these statues have been there since, I believe, Teddy Roosevelt.
Right.
Now, President Obama becomes the first African-American president, and I never hear really any talk about this in any way. And then, all of a sudden, it's an issue, and I see that, I believe these numbers are correct, that groups like the KKK and Nazi groups have went up by something like 23% enrollment in the last 2 years. Why now? What is going on?
I have an opinion, and my opinion may be no greater or less weight than someone else's, but my first reaction is that I think those groups perceive and believe, rightly or wrongly, that under the current administration, the President of the United States, that I don't want to use an overused word like more fashionable, but it's okay if they held views supporting slavery and supporting basically white supremacy, that it's okay for them to express that, because as the president said, there were good people on both sides. In other words, they consider themselves to be part of the good people on the side of the Confederacy, forgetting a little simple thing that, you know, something is either right or wrong. Something is either immoral or moral. So there can't be a little bit of morality on one side and a little bit of immorality on the other side. And they're both entitled to, no, it's something is either right or wrong, just or unjust. And I think that we don't have a sufficient time in this interview here for me to go through some of the things which I indicate that I think they see under this president a more comfortable environment to express their opinions. Now, when Obama was president, of course, we have to remember there were some virulent, reaction to him, and they, you know, people walking around with guns, postcards and pictures with watermelons on the front lawn of the White House. I mean, there were pro-anti-racist statements, but the country got through it. And so, you see, I think in that, let me try to want to bore you or your audience too much. Basically, we have not as a country had what those of us in the, have some religious background. The country has not had what I call a come to Jesus moment. You know, come on. We have to stop all this nonsense and say, now come on, let's see what this is all about. Okay. We know no matter how it is dressed up, that the institution of slavery and this pernicious rationale of white supremacy, that institution and its legacy has dominated generation after generation of black and white people, the great-great-grandsons of slaves and the great-great-grandsons of slave owners, up until the day day of this conversation I'm having right now. And sooner or later, preferably sooner, we're going to have to address it. We've got to stop dancing around this issue. It's, America is such a fantastic country. And I mean that in all sincerity. I mean, the greatest country in the world. I'm proud to be an American. I tell that to everybody. Now, the fact that I'm proud of being an American doesn't mean I'm blind, stupid, and dumb. But I can't see some of the defects. And one of the major defects that we have is that we have this unresolved issue of race, and we've got to stop, dancing around it. Sometimes I have hope that what they call the millennials, that somehow they'll be free and maybe to look at this differently. I can tell you that indeed, there was a musical. Many of your audience, unless they're senior citizens like I am, they don't remember the Broadway show South Pacific. There's a lyric in that song that says, "You have to be taught to hate. You have to be carefully taught to hate." So this, we can have all the technology of people on the moon. I'm sitting here talking to you in Silicon Valley, the center of the universe of technology, and still it doesn't matter what Apple and Facebook and Intuit and Salesforce and all the other people achieve. Until we resolve this issue of race, it's going to just sap the very energy of the best that the country can be. And what happens is that people are intimidated. People are unwilling to unwilling to just be candid. I used to, like some people, I've heard white people say, well, some of my best friends are Negroes. Well, that's okay. Well, I can say that clearly some of my best friends, dearest, closest friends are white. But at the same time, I take the position, and this gets me into a great political discussion with some of my dearest friends, because I say, presumptively, every person who is white in America, everyone, presumptively, every white person in America is infected by the pernicious virus of white racism unless they get information that helps them overcome it.
It's
sad that we live in an environment we have a national administration that seems to encourage that.
Well, that's the question. CNN is doing a great documentary series called The 2000s.
Right,
And last night's episode was on President Obama's election.
Right.
And it's interesting because I remember I was in the media when President Obama was elected, and
right.
he won by a large margin. He gave that
right.
great speech in Chicago in front of a gigantic
right.
crowd, said change has come to America. The next morning, a lot of morning shows ran the I Have a Dream speech, which certainly you are familiar with.
Right.
That this had come and this had changed. But a lot of people are saying now, had there not been President Obama, would we have gotten President Trump?
Oh, that's interesting, That's interesting. It's almost like this is a counter reaction to the election of President Obama. That's interesting. I could not discount. I mean, an argument could be made. An argument could be made that is so. That is under President Obama, there were significant segments of the population or institutions in America for one reason or another, felt more threatened than they had ever felt by what they saw in the African-American president and the policies in his cabinet and the policies that he carried out, that this could be similar to what, you know, the what I call the counter-revolution after the Civil War. It had Reconstruction, which tried to implement what had been won on the battlefield, you know, the end of slavery and equal rights and so forth. And then you had a reaction to that. So that's plausible.
Well, there,
that's plausible. There's, I mean, I would not discount that. But I think it's a much more fundamental thing, and I don't want to sound like a broken record. I think bottom line is that we, as we have this conversation today, and as people who are listening to your show, they have to be honest. We have to be candid with one another. We are successors to an earlier generation that that had an institution of slavery. We fought this country. The only time this country ever had a major conflict on this soil, 620,000 people were lost in the Civil War. If that were extrapolated in terms of the percentage of the population, that would be about 7 million people were killed in our own Civil War, based on our population today. All right? So this divided the country. And unfortunately, those magnificent words that Lincoln wrote, the Gettysburg Address, and the magnificent words of Obama in his speech, and magnificent words of my beloved brother Martin Luther King Jr. in August 28, 1963. Everybody's trying to build on and carry out the dream or the belief of what everybody thought was the moral core of where America was after the Civil War and after the passage of all the legislation, the civil rights and so forth. But the fact of the matter is, there has been a reaction, and I think the reaction is similar to the reaction that followed the abolition of slavery. It's like almost a counter-revolution is taking place to roll back what had been achieved through the election of Barack Obama.
Well, you know, just on a personal level, it's interesting because from the time President Obama announced he was running, I remember the famous moment in the debates where John McCain was asked by the lady, he said President Obama wasn't even born, and he said, no ma'am, that's not true. Well, John McCain lost that election.
Right.
Romney did not take that attack, and he lost that election.
Right.
But Donald Trump was the lead birther, and he won.
Right. Well, I have said, you know, it's a bad. I know. You got to be careful with analogies. So I'll run the risk. But in South Africa, for example, where you had a brutal regime of apartheid, Francis F.W. de Klerk, who represented the Afrikaner Party, that imposed rigid, brutal apartheid. When Mandela, after some 27 years in prison, comes out and he's elected president, Mandela and F.W. de Klerk and this great clergyman, Desmond Tutu, they had the foresight to understand, now hold on, we're not going to be able to make a peaceful transition from a formerly brutal, racist apartheid regime into a multiracial South Africa until we enable the nation to nationally confront what apartheid was and what happened. And so I believe, as I said earlier, I believe the nation nearly needs to have eventually a national come to Jesus meeting about racism in America. We've never, it's got to be just a avoiding this issue. Stop, you know, think that there's something fashionable about keeping these monuments. The country has to come to understand that such an extraordinary country that has had space achievements and technological information dissemination achievements, medicine, that we're caught in the grips of this virus, of this animus, of race that still, it's like an Ebola infection, or I don't know, it's like something that we can't get out of our system. And until we do get it out of our system, your listeners, people in your generation, black and white, okay, we're just going to be talking about this. We need to put this issue to rest once and for all.
How do we do it?
As I say, I understand, you know, I'm 87 going on 88, and I come out of that movement with Dr. King. I think you got to have a national dialogue with the country. I guess I could write a fairyland, a fairy tale script in which one day one president, just as he's taking office, he says, you know, President X, the next president, he says, I've looked back on where we've come. And we elected an African-American president and so forth. First African-American president, but you know, I've looked at the landscape. And we can't go any further until we as a nation come to grips with this issue of race. We cannot go any further, you know. And so we've had the Kerner Committee. We don't need any more commissions. We don't need any more study groups. We don't need any more studies, okay? We have to have some. The national government could do it. Maybe a consortium of the major leaders of religions in the country could come together. And think about it. I'm sorry. January 15th, 2019, it will be the 90th. Birthday of Martin Luther King Jr. What an extraordinary thing if in a week of celebration, the King National Holiday, which we do every year, but this year is going to be the 90th birthday, if the country or some group would say, we've got to deal with this. With all due respect to the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. in his I Have a Dream speech, this is his 90th birthday. We as a country, as Obama said in his Democratic Party convention, you're not a red state, a blue state, a black, you know, we're the United States of America. And I don't look at my brothers and sisters who are members of the Klan as my enemy. I look at them as people who are ill-informed, as people who, if they really sat down calmly and looked at what they were supporting, are those young people? I mean, imagine last year there were young white men and women walking around with torches saying, the Jews will not replace us. Well, give me a break. The people in this audience, they need to go and study something called Kristallnacht in Germany. So that was the famous time when the National Socialist Party under Hitler created an incident in which they went around and smashed all of the windows of Jewish shopkeepers. The rise of Nazism. All right, but we've got to. Is the Klan monuments? Is that who we are in America? Is that who we want to represent us going forward? Okay.
Well,
or do we really believe, notwithstanding it's 50 years later, that there really was some validity to this Baptist preacher? Was he foolish and stupid and just an idle dreamer? You know? Or was he just prescient when he said on the night before he was assassinated, I've been to the mountaintop and I looked across and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there, but we as a people with the promise. He's talking about not just black people seeing the end of segregation. He's talking about America being the best that we can do, be. And I wish there were, I mean, you have a radio show, and I commend you because you have topic issues, all right? I mean, you can't just talk about race every day, obviously, on your program, so I understand that. But at the end of the day, you and your listeners know that the unresolved issue of race in America, in Ohio, Texas, New York, California, Rhode Island, Nevada, Minnesota, go on. That's the monkey that's on our back. That's the opioid addiction that has the whole nation in a addicted crisis of racism. Simply stated, the belief that just because someone has a different color or different texture to their hair, that for some reason they are not entitled to the same rights and opportunities as somebody else.
You know, it's
the black people I know, they don't want to be over the white people. They don't want to be. I'm not saying to my white brother and sister, no, I don't want to be equal with you. I want you to know I'm black and I'm better than you. No, that's ridiculous. I'm just simply saying this extraordinary country, you know, I mean, there must be members of your audience who have been in the military, you know, the Iraq War, the Vietnam War. I was a veteran in the Korean War. I mean, there is no greater country with all of our defects. And with all the criticism you've heard me on this program and other program about the United States, why do I say these things about how I feel? Because I love this country so much. And I believe it's such an extraordinary experiment in government that's been gripped by this cancer of racism that keeps eating away at our tissues. And we have sufficient advances in medicine and technology that we can get rid of this virus if we just face up to it.
Well, it's fascinating. In the last 18 minutes, I want to turn for a second because you have a unique perspective of representing somebody who was at points under investigation by the FBI.
Right.
Our current president is under investigation by the FBI and a special counsel. He fired this morning Peter Schrock, the third person. Comey, Schrock, mm-hmm. and McCabe have now been fired.
Mm-hmm.
We see his attorney, Rudy Giuliani, on all the programs. We know what the investigation's about. We know who's been indicted. We know who's taken plea deals. We know who's on trial.
This is about alleged collusion with Russia.
Collusion with Russia. And the thing I want to, before I get your opinion on this, the last indictment was very interesting because it's very detailed. It spoke to two things. Number one, that 39 states had their voter rolls hacked into and 500,000 people's information was compromised. Beyond that, there hasn't been any more, but the investigation's not over. And also, when Trump got on the stage and said, Russia, look for Hillary's emails,
right,
29
right,
minutes
right.
later, they did. Yeah. So, what do you think?
Well, I think that, I think it's more likely than not, okay? It's more likely than not that Russia tried to interfere in our election process, as they do not only in our country but other countries. But I have been saying that we have to look at the last 50 years. There's a book called The Legacy of Ashes. It's written by a fellow by the name of Tom Weiner. It's the history of the CIA. The United States routinely interfered in the elections of governments and countries for years in Europe, in Asia. We did that. That was routine. In some instances, in Latin America, we actually sent in troops to change the result of the election. So I just assume I'm more cynical and practical. I said, yeah, Russia interfered in our election, just as the United States has done and probably is still doing. Okay. The question that obviously the American people want to know is, to what extent, if any, did the current president of the United States abet? I mean, did he? Well, was he participating with Russia? Was he aiding and abetting this interference? Or, as he says, there was no collusion. I didn't, you know. I guess he wanted to have it both ways. He wanted the intervention of Russia to undermine the Hillary Clinton campaign to enhance his own opportunity to get elected, without at the same time in any way being, quote, a co-conspirator with the Russian government. I don't. That's yet to be proved, that whether or not he, in fact, or any of his representatives, colluded with Russia. That's the issue. I don't doubt that Russia interfered, just as I don't doubt, I know historically, in fact, that over the years, the United States has interfered in the elections of many, many countries. Okay. So, it's sad. It's sad. It's sad that the President of the United States has put himself in the position of denying what most people who know anything about real politics and goes on in America knows, that it's more likely than not, as they say, that the Russians tried to influence and interfere in the election. Now, that they did it, the question, did they do it independent? Did they do it in conjunction, in cooperation, or, quote, to use that nasty word, in a co-conspiracy with representatives of the Trump campaign? I don't think they did. I don't believe so. I'd be surprised. I can't imagine anyone being that stupid, because that's by definition, that's treason.
Well,
yeah.
Up until about a month ago, I'm with you on that, and still I want to see the final report, but I'm confused about the Trump Putin summit, that 45-minute press conference.
Right.
For a lot of reasons, because if there's one thing we know about President Trump, it's that right. When he gets hit, he hits back harder. He didn't, and Putin says in an open meeting, "Well, this is who I wanted to win."
Right, that's correct.
Why did he want him to win?
Right, I understand. I understand, but you see, that what you said is true. But I happen to believe that that is a subordinate and diversionary issue. Russia has its own national interest, and they believe that perhaps having a president other than Hillary Clinton. I think what they were more against Hillary Clinton than they were for Donald Trump. That's my belief. I hope what I believe is true, I'll be very disappointed if, in fact, Mueller comes up with evidence that, in fact, representatives of the Trump campaign or the president himself colluded, that is, acted in concert with the Russian government to get him elected. I don't believe that is so. I don't believe it occurred, and so since I don't believe it occurred, I don't think I think it's an issue that's overblown out of all proportion, because that's the issue that still remains. Having said that, I'm not deaf, dumb, and blind yet, obviously. There was just a report recently about how Russia tried to hack into the voting machines of several states. But I'm not surprised. People like this. It's like that scene in Casablanca about the guy comes with this gambling going on in his house. Of course there's gambling going on. Of course the Russians did it. The only question is, did Trump aid and abet it? And as I said, I don't believe that he did. I could be proven wrong. I can't believe that he'd be so stupid to do that.
The only two oddities to me that are out there that still make this a possibility are, number one, his reactions to the investigation, and number two, why did he never show his taxes? What was the reason? He's rich. He said he's rich.
My opinion is just another opinion with me and other opinions. My personal opinion is that it probably had to do that maybe he was less, the tax returns would show that he, in fact, is less wealthy than he says or claims to be. And the other reason relevant to this Russia thing may indicate that in his borrowings and loans, maybe he is indebted to banks, overseas banks under the control of the Russians, you know. Maybe that's what he's concerned about. Maybe he's got multi-million-dollar loans in his private business. When you go behind the loans, that the loans were, the money was provided by Russian banks. That I don't know.
It'll be interesting to see what happens. I want to come back to something here for the last 9 minutes, and I don't know how much credibility this person can be given, but one of President Trump's top aides, Omarosa, from The Apprentice, has written a book now and played some tapes on Meet the Press yesterday to show that she does have these tapes. Now, The big question yesterday was, she said that she never heard the president use the N-word, but she believed that he had racist tendencies, and that she had heard the tape in which he says the N-word, and that apparently people are going to use that as a October surprise for the upcoming elections. If there's a tape of him say, well, do you believe it, coming from her? And if there is, how's that going to spin out in the elections?
Well, first of all, everybody's like, it's a big surprise. I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not surprised. I have to assume that Trump used the N-word. If someone said to me, no, Donald Trump never used the N-word, I said, really? over the period of his 20 years, everything you know about him. So I don't think that's a major issue. The question is, for this lady's own self-interest, apparently whatever his deficiencies on the question of race were, she was prepared to overlook them for her own self-interest. I think that's a distraction, you know. He probably did. Many people in business, many white people in business have used it. You tell me that many people running corporations today can say they never used the N-word in the last 20 years. I doubt that. So any white people, I doubt that. I'm sure sure there are some that, in fact, have never used it, but I think it's a small minority. That's the tentacles of racism very deeply embedded in our culture. Most white men that I have been fortunate to know, is that if they ever use that word earlier, they certainly is not part of their lexicon or their DNA today. That's not who they are.
Well, this becomes the large question, and maybe this is where this all culminates in the last 5 minutes of our interview, because we look at the birther thing, we look at maybe the N-word was used, we look at Charlottesville, good people on both sides, we look at how he referred to President Obama during his presidency. What is, would Donald Trump be considered somebody who had racist tendencies, or is he a person who's playing to a group of people who have racist tendencies?
I would say that Donald Trump is just a cutout and an exemplar of a lot of white people in America today. I'm not surprised. That doesn't mean that they're basically evil people. Okay? That Donald Trump, I think, is a unique unique example, because I think that he'll do or say whatever is necessary that he believes to win. It doesn't matter, whatever it is. Whatever it is, as long as he doesn't have to openly break the law, he'll do and say whatever is necessary to win at all costs. Whatever it may be. That means taping somebody, that means saying the N-word. That means whatever it is, he'll do it.
Well, this brought up an interesting question yesterday, because I had never heard it put this way before. Because good things have happened under Trump. There are things that are good. But somebody said yesterday, nobody remembers George Wallace's tax plan.
Right.
So
I like that. That's good. Nobody remembers George Wallace's tax plan. That's true. In other words, notwithstanding the fact that Trump's reports on the economy are looking good, that the other things that he's doing overshadows some of the things that he has really done. Although, and we don't have enough time in this interview, I think that the real threat to Donald Trump is one. Is an expansionist. On the one hand, he's contradictory. An expansionist, he doesn't want to be involved in foreign things, and yet he does get involved in foreign wars, directly, indirectly. And the other thing is that he's running a credit card of the company. The country has the largest debt in its history. The largest debt in its history. And guess who our biggest creditor is? Guess. China.
Yep. Well,
there are more. China is holding more dollars, U.S. dollars, in its foreign exchange reserve account than any other country.
I can't imagine this trade war is going to end well. But with 2 minutes left, and I hate to ask a hypothetical, but I'm going to ask it in this way, because you certainly knew Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and 90th birthday around the corner. 50th commemoration of the assassination this year.
Right.
President Trump, in all likelihood, will be president when the 90th birthday happens. Now, here's the hypothetical.
Well, that assumes he. Well, either way, if he gets reelected, yes. If he gets defeated, he'll still be president.
That's right.
Before the new incoming president takes office on January 20th.
So. President Trump, almost 2 years into his presidency, LeBron James, here in Ohio, was asked about 10 days ago by Don Lemon, what would you say if you were sitting across from the president? And he said, I wouldn't sit across from this president. Would Martin Luther King Jr. at this point in the Trump presidency sit across from him?
Here, I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of controversial reactions. You say, sit across from him. Yes, I think that Martin King would sit across from him as he would sit across from the most racist governor. He'd sit across the table from George Wallace if he had the opportunity. He would not, and I'm probably going to have people, well, Clarence Jones has lost his mind. But first of all, in Dr. King's eyes, he was a Baptist preacher, remember, every sinner has the capacity to be redeemed. Okay? So I can't imagine that he would refuse to talk with President Trump. I don't think he would say, well, I'm not going to meet with President Trump unless he does A, B, C, D, and E. I think the direct answer to your question is that I think he would have such confidence in himself and in his beliefs that he believes that he could sit across the table with Donald Trump, and Martin King is not going to be changed by the meeting. Martin King's not going to change, okay? If there's any change possible at all, it will occur by Mr. Trump, Martin King. I firmly believe that, yes, I'm being a little repetitive. So if you get a lot of people calling in and say, well, I heard Professor Jones, he must have lost his mind, well, I stand by that. I think Martin King had a great deal of self-assurance. Remember, he used to tell people, I'm a minister of the God before I was a civil rights leader. And as a minister of the God, he deeply believed, using his words, in his Lord Jesus Christ. And I think that he would sit across from any human being, any person, because he believed in the power of redemption. That everybody has the capacity to change.
I'm going to stay 1 minute over just to ask this question because I think it's important. 6 months away from the 90th birthday,
right.
Ironically, and probably, it's probable that he could still have been alive, the Reverend King.
He would be 90.
He'd be 90, which
right.
is possible.
Right.
If he were alive, 90 years would have been 90 years. He would have seen the election of Obama and the election
right.
of Trump. Would he
right.
still be optimistic or pessimistic at 90 years old?
Optimistic.
Optimistic. Clarence B. Jones, speechwriter, professor, friend, lawyer of the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It's always a pleasure to have you on, Professor
always
Jones.
Always a pleasure to be invited, Scott.
Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you for having me, and for your listeners, thank you for being patient for an aging professor here in Silicon Valley.
You stay well. LeBron's coming your way, so you'll have a good basketball team, and we'll talk in
oh,
the
wow,
future.
Oh, wow, yes. So he's quite an extraordinary
absolutely.
Person.
Stay
thank
well.
You. Thank you so much again.
Bye-bye.
Right, good.
All right, that's all the time we have today. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
The DH offices are located at 559 East Center Street in the lower level of the Beltone Building. Thank you so much for playing fair.
Tecumseh, fascinating, mesmerizing. Be sure.